Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Yasmin Khan, a reporter here at KUNM. This summer marks the 50th anniversary of the 1971 Chicano-led rebellion against police brutality and racism that began in Albuquerque's Roosevelt Park. The rebellion is a key but often overlooked moment in New Mexico's Chicano history. 50 years later, it serves as a reminder of the long record of police violence, resistance, and collaboration between people of color in our state, and remains especially relevant in the wake of the 2020 Black Lives Matter uprising and the social inequities highlighted by the global pandemic. Today, we will hear about the importance of New Mexico's Chicano movement, not only for New Mexico's history, but also how it impacted and influenced Black and Brown resistance in the United States as a whole. We will discuss what sparked the 1971 uprising, how it changed the movement, the importance of Brown Rebellion in New Mexico, and where New Mexico's Chicano movement is headed. And we want to hear from you. Did you or someone you know participate in the 1971 rebellion or other Chicano or Latino-led protests in New Mexico? What was that experience like? How would you like to see communities of color work together in New Mexico? Join the conversation. Email us at letstalk@kunm.org or call in during the show at 277-5866. And I'd like to welcome Richard Moore to the show. Richard is a former Black Beret who participated in the 1971 rebellion, and he's co-founder of the Los Jardines Institute, an educational and agricultural nonprofit in the South Valley. In June, President Biden appointed Richard to the first White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, and he's also an active member of the Environmental Protection Agency's National Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So June 13th was the 50th anniversary of the police attack on Chicano families gathered in Roosevelt Park and the violent aftermath of that brutality. That event was national news, and news outlets around the country presented it in different ways, some calling it a riot, others a rebellion against racism and police violence. I'd like to get your reaction to how CBS News portrayed the rebellion in a national broadcast the following day.
Albuquerque's Roosevelt Park was filled with young people, 500 to 1,000. But when undercover agents in the crowd called in uniformed police to make arrests for public drinking, it turned to violence. Rocks and bottles were thrown. Police fired back with shotguns and pistols, mostly in the air, but one young person was wounded. Led by a militant Mexican-American group, about 500 young people marched downtown, setting fires, breaking windows, and looting. 36 fires in all, with early losses set at $2 million. Bill Curtis, CBS News, Albuquerque.
Richard, what goes through your mind when you hear that report?
Well, I mean, I think that in terms of the media, particularly the national media, that that the incorrect information that's presented by the media. I think for many of us that were extremely active then and are still active today, that we know that history a little bit better. And so the best people to talk about history is those that were engaged in that history at that moment.
And what happened that day from your perspective?
Well, I think one of the comments that I would need to make is that we need to be able to look back to what led up to the rebellion at Roosevelt Park. And I'll just touch on a very couple of things very, very quickly. One, that there was an incredible amount of activism that was not only taking place in Albuquerque, but taking place throughout the state of New Mexico. And some of that activism was concentrated around police repression and police brutality. Now, what I will say is that if we just take a moment and we look at that history, one was the incredible amount of organizing that was taking place in the communities. Any issue that you talk about, lack of health care, lack of employment, lack of child care, police repression, resources, land grants, water rights. I mean, you name it, and there was an organization that was working on those issues. That's very important to flag. I think it's secondly, as if we look at what was going on during that time around the state, we've seen a lot of activity taking place in northern New Mexico and some of the smaller villages in the north, But then also, if we look at Central and if we look at Southern New Mexico, the same, a lot of activity, a lot of mobilization, a lot of demonstrations, a lot of issues that were being peaked out all over the state of New Mexico. So that's very, very important for us to understand when it comes to Roosevelt Park. Roosevelt Park was a response of just people being tired of being tired, and deciding that they were not going to put up with this kind of repression that's been imposed upon by the military forces, and including the Sheriff's Department, the State Police, and the Albuquerque Police Department.
Mm-hmm. And do you see similarities in how the media portrayed that 1971 event to how Black Lives Matter and other protests from communities of color are presented in the media today?
Well, I would very clearly see some similarities. As I said, if we just look at, for a moment, that police repression, there was many young people and other people, not only in the city of Albuquerque, but throughout the state, that were being killed by military forces, particularly police departments. There's a long list of those folks in African-American communities in the South Broadway area that was very active during this time period. And then at the same time within the Chicano communities and within the movement. So there is similarities. We need to be able to identify some of those similarities in order to move forward with where do we need to go from here. But a lot of similarities. Now, just will quickly also add, the unity between Native Indigenous people and organizations, African-American organizations and Chicano organizations were crucial. That unity between students at universities, particularly today at the University of New Mexico, and communities and community members it was such a dynamic and an exciting moment in that history to see our people across the board coming together.
Mm. Thank you. And we have a call from Joaquin from Polvadera. Joaquin, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, buenos dias. My name is Joaquin Luján. I'm a small farmer in Polvadera, rancho entre dos acequias, but I'm originally from the North Valley of Albuquerque, north of Old Town from Los Duranes, and so that's where my family dates back a few hundred years or whatnot, and that's where I was raised, and that's where I started seeing what was happening to my life and to my family's life and to my neighbors' lives in and around Los Duranes. At just trying to give an idea as to how I was seeing things starting up from the age of six and how quickly I was able to see what was happening. So I'm 69 years old, and at about 5 or 6 years old, there was already old heroin addicts in Los Duranes. So you got to figure that heroin was put into our barrios, into our communities, late 20s, in the 20s or whatever, if we already had, when I was a kid, old drug addicts. And so it was running rampant in and around the barrios, up and down the North and South Valleys. You can see it. You can see what was been happening to our communities, I guess, since the invasion or whenever it is that we were no longer just our own communities. And pretty much by the time I was 16, 15, we were like in Mexico, like a pimple ready to burst. And that was throughout the state. I mean, you can start seeing already the actions of the land grant folk, you know, battling and fighting and actually having the military and the police start gathering folk and putting them on behind corrals while they were looking for Reyes Tejerina and whatnot. I'm 15. I'm hearing that in Los Duranes in Albuquerque, already out of school. There was no... not much happening there for the likes of me. And so at that point, there was a Bomberry organization that had started in Albuquerque, and I became a part of that. And but that didn't last. I mean, we were all young and a lot of different things happening. And so I think at the end of 68, the likes of myself, Richard, and a whole lot of other folk got together. And so the Black Berets came about. And so we were youth, young, found ourselves ending up being militant because of the pressure we were getting from the police and from the cowards like the Minutemen organization, who would call us or would bomb our cars or burn them. But you never saw them, just like today, you don't see them. I mean, you hear them and they don't confront. Mm. And so a lot of that was happening. And like Richard mentioned, things were happening throughout the state.
Mm-hmm.
And our connection in and around southern New Mexico or northern New Mexico, just based on the issues, we started working with each other. And so it's important to say that the struggle obviously started, or the resistance, or whatever you want to call it, way before the riot.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a lot of us were prepared for that riot in the sense that we had already been dealing with police brutality. In our organization, we already had a community patrol that was stopping up and down Central every time police stopped a person of color,
mm-hmm.
just to be witnesses. That was 50 years ago. 60 years, whatever, 50.
Mm-hmm.
All of that confrontation. And so I was a part of that. But I have to say, in Mexico, pretty much everybody was a part of that because we were all victims.
Okay.
And so we had different levels, and that's important to say, of the Chicano movement. Those of us that were doing the militant thing, there was others that, doing different things, educating on Nuestra Cultura, because up till the Movimiento, I was being called Jackie. My name was changed in the first grade from Joaquin to Jackie. And so already all those things were happening in terms of the pressure.
Yeah.
And all of those things lead up to what happened.
Yeah. Thank you, Joaquin. Yeah, I'm sure there was a full range of issues that preceded the event, and then the rebellion or the protest or however the uprising changed the landscape after for the Chicano movement. And I just want to ask, Richard, can you very briefly explain the difference between the Black Berets and the Brown Berets, which have now a resurgence of people joining Brown Berets here in New Mexico. Can you just give a couple points of difference between those two groups?
I mean, I think one of the important things is when the Black Beret organization, New Mexico's Black Berets, as we always refer to, because the Black Berets belong to the people of New Mexico. And I think Joaquin may be touched. Joaquin was Minister of Defense in the Black Beret organization during that time. And I, along with others that held different leadership positions in the Black Berets, I was Minister of Justice for the Black Berets. And so just to quickly identify that difference, I think one for us that we knew that we need to have, because our elders were telling us that you need to be extremely disciplined, extremely, extremely disciplined, and always connect New Mexico's history to everything that you do, programs that you institute or whatever. So we worked very close with the Brown Berets during that time. But at the same time, we decided to call ourselves New Mexico Black Berets. There was Black Beret chapters all over the Southwest, all over the country. The first Black Beret organization was founded by a young Chicano in San Jose, California, South Candelaria. And we decided to call ourselves the Black Berets in honor of Ernesto Che Guevara and the internationalism and the work that Che was involved in during that time.
All right. Thank you, Richard. We do have to go for a break. If you want to join the conversation about Chicano and Chicana history and activism in New Mexico, give us a call at 277-5866. You can also tweet to us with the hashtag Let's Talk NM. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
On the next Alternative Radio, hear part two of Chris Hedges on American sadism. That's Alternative Radio, Saturday evenings at 6, right here on 89.9 FM KUNM, KUNM.org, Albuquerque.
When composer Elena Ruhr wrote this, she was thinking of an abbey high above the Rhine River and a composer who lived and worked there 900 years ago. Coming up, 21st century music inspired by the 12th century composer Hildegard von Bingen on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Yasmin Khan. This morning, we're talking with Robert Moore. And up next, I'd also like to introduce Sofia Martinez. Sofia is co-founder of Los Jardines Institute. She's also a co-founder of Voices Feministas, a radio show highlighting women of color here on KUNM. Sofia has been an educator in New Mexico for more than 17 years. And although she was not at the rebellion that day in 1971, she has participated in the movement for decades. Welcome to the show, Sofia.
Thank you.
Sofia, many people connect Chicano protests and uprising in the 1960s and 70s to farm worker movements in California. But there was a lot happening in New Mexico during that era, including movements that expanded beyond worker protests. Can you tell us how New Mexico has been positioned in the national Chicano movement and how that position has changed in recent years?
Well, I think at that time it wasn't just the farm workers in California. I mean, Reyes Lopez Tijerina, along with other people in the land grant movement, were leading kind of the land grant movement. Corky in Denver was leading kind of the educational arm of the Chicano movement. And Jose Angel Gutierrez, kind of the political arm, right, in Texas, because they started the Partido de la Raza Unida. So, again, most people don't know history. Don't know the history, right? And oftentimes, as we spoke earlier, the history is written either by intellectuals or scholars that aren't from New Mexico that come here and do their research. And oftentimes, it's only in the library. They don't recognize that there are actual people that they could speak to and get primary sources, right? Because it's important in research. And so, we have a lot of historical inaccuracies. And I think that there's a bit of an ahistorical positioning right now that, you know, we really kind of need to interrogate and break down. No? But focus me again. Tell me the question. I kind of lost it. I got into this.
No. Yeah, that's exactly excellent background. And can you tell us how New Mexico is positioned in the national Chicana movement in recent years?
Yes. Well, and again, just looking at a little bit of history in terms of El Grito del Norte, which was a very important newspaper and is at the library at UNM, basically documents, I think, the political sophistication of New Mexico at that time, led in a lot of ways, not only by leadership in New Mexico, including the Black Berets and the time period where the Brown Berets were in effect, but the role of Betita Elizabeth Martinez, who recently passed away. And she, along with some other people, including the Black Berets, created the Chicano Communications Center, which did a lot of publications and really became a voice for New Mexico. And again, that paper, I think, was pretty sophisticated in terms of really hooking up the local to the national, international, right? And then when we look locally, I think, again, when I speak to people that have recently come out of college, they they really don't even know about this stuff. Like in 1971, when the rebellion happened, that same year, the National Guard came on to the University of New Mexico with bayonets and poked and stabbed people, students on the University of New Mexico. Just 3 years later, in 1967, the courthouse raid had happened, and the National Guard basically went into Canjilon up in the Tierra Maria area, rounded up the people there, and put them in a corral with the animals, right? And then three years later, 1970 at UNM, the same National Guard sent by the governors goes into UNM with bayonets and basically attack students with bayonets there. And then you have the rebellion, a really characterizes a riot in those days, because again, there's no difference today between then that capitalism and the structures of capitalism control all the narratives. I mean, let's be serious. The news hasn't changed much since then. You might see a few more people of color, but really, they're not controlling the media. And the more and more that we control people of color's voices from the state of New Mexico aren't heard, and the lens through which we speak on media, you know, the we never get the story in a lot of ways. And again, even with academia, that still has to be challenged. Why is it that today we still have such an ahistorical memory for students? Students should be graduating of University of New Mexico with a really strong understanding of New Mexico history. Mm. That's a little bit of an issue, right? We have a lot of organizations today. We had fewer organizations then. We have much more organizations now. But yet, I think there's a little bit more coalition building that needs to happen. Our issues are very different, and we somehow have to kind of really identify those issues on which we can agree on and move forward. And then really, again, this ahistorical perspective doesn't allow us to understand what has happened before, so we can be where we're at. Like, I think a lot of, you know, there's a lot of language that's being tossed out today. A lot of stuff that we really need to, we can't just talk about decolonizing and deconstructing. The language doesn't mean anything if there's not some action put mm-hmm. behind it, right? So there's a lot of stuff that should be being deconstructed and decolonized right now and being challenged, but people don't want to challenge it because of money, right? Because again, we do live in a capitalist racist society, and money is what basically, and power is what's dominating a lot of stuff. So we still have the same issues. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, how many New Mexican voices do you hear? How many institutions in New Mexico are led by New Mexicans? You know what I'm saying? There's a real big difference between the local we speak for ourselves and the outside lens that come. And it doesn't matter whether it's a white lens or, to a great degree, Latinas, O's, X that come from either the bi-coastal areas of the United States or other places. In a lot of, and so the immigrant lens is also very different from the historical minority lens, right? Mm-hmm. So those things aren't interrogated, those things aren't presented, and so that creates a lot of issues in terms of people really coming together in coalitions. I think I'm just thinking a lot of things in terms of similarities. There's a lot of similarities between the Black Lives Matter and during that time. But I think, although it's very important as political people, we understand what Black Lives Matter mean and that all other mm-hmm. lives are important as well. But at the same time, there is a little bit of a competition that's being set up, although it's very subliminal in a lot of ways, like mm-hmm. BIPOC. Let's take that for example. It took decades for most people of color across the country, and I'm just talking about the country because the international scene is a whole other thing, to agree to being called people of color, even though there's always been issues with that, right? But now with the BIPOC, I mean, who really created it? Has that been broken down? Has that been decolonized? Because that's really setting up people of color in a competitive situation, right? And I think that we need to break that down. It's not totally liberatory. It's constructed and under the context of U.S. Racist capitalism. You know? So how do we break that down? And then 2 months ago, I got a bill from PNM, and there was a little flyer in there like BIPOC funding now available. What does that mean? What does that mean in New Mexico in terms of history? You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. and people of color here and equity and, you know, all this other stuff. And what does diversity and equity and inclusion mean nowadays? Is it just a gatekeeping kind of department now in every agency and in every institution? Mm-hmm. So The context has changed, but the issues have remained. And the organizing is not as fierce. And I don't know. And there was always like the Black Berets were all considered, Richard said it, militant, radical, right? And there has always been a distaste by capitalism for people of color being conceived as powerful. No, we're just thugs and criminals and the mob, the riot, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. And Sophia, since the Black Lives Matter movement here and around the country in 2020, have you seen changes in how communities of color work together in New Mexico?
I think there's differences. I think that when people say, oh, has it become more exclusive of Whitman and X and, you know, I think that there was almost just as much inclusion. The power dynamics are changing because women are, challenging sexism. Well, not just machismo, because machismo has a little bit of a sexist, racist implications, right? Because sexism exists in every language. Why do we want to pick out the word machismo as being a Spanish word that kind of symbolizes that kind of sexism? So we all live under patriarchy. And even the romantic idea of maternally led indigenous nations, I mean, that's... the idea is there in the goal, but let's be serious. We all live under patriarchy and we're all influenced by it, whether we want to admit or we think that we're like beyond just a human being.
Okay.
Beings, right? So we need to reflect on that kind of stuff. But so I think there was as much exclusion, but now it has become a lot about identity.
Okay. Thank you, Sophia. I'm going to jump in and take a caller. We have Steve Martinez from Santa Fe. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I just wanted to, I'm a history professor at Santa Fe Community College. I wanted to add some historical context that you kind of movement began in here in New Mexico during the Mexican-American War when Mexicanos fought to liberate New Mexico from the American army occupation led by Manuel Cortez in the last year of the Mexican-American War. And then in the 19th century, of course, the land grant movements, Las Gordas Blancas, Mano Negro. So in the 1930s, miners were, Mexicano Chicano miners were organizing in New Mexico. And then, of course, in the 1940s, Senator Dennis Chavez basically wrote all of the language for the civil rights movement. And unfortunately, he died in 1962. But his good friend, Lyndon B. Johnson, made sure that the civil rights movement language written by his good friend, Dennis Chavez, was implemented. And so New Mexico has a history. It's the foundation of Chicano activism is here. You know, Tiny Martinez, when he returned from World War II in Las Vegas, New Mexico, realized that Highlands University needed, you know, activism from Hispanics or Chicanos. They formed the AZIs in the 1950s, the first Hispanic fraternity in the history of the United States. They later built the groundwork for the Chicano movement, and Highlands University played a central role in the history of the United States of Chicano activism. Mm-hmm. And that was built off the foundation of Tiny Martinez, and then later Juan Jose Peña, Anselmo Arellano, and many others. And I wanted to do one last shout-out, and that is to recognize the Center for Regional Studies at the University of New Mexico. Toby Duran... it was really instrumental in getting that thing going. Mm-hmm. Manny Aragon provided the funding, you know, to get the Center for Regional Studies going. That became an intellectual hub at the University of New Mexico for ensuring that Chicanos and Chicanas could get their degrees, their advanced degrees. I'm a byproduct of the Center for Regional Studies. I know Richard Moore is also. So I just wanted to kind of quickly throw that in. I was out doing my walk, and I stopped here at a park bench to call in and remind folks that New Mexico is the Chicano movement in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. There would not be activism without New Mexico.
Thank
and
you.
That can never be forgotten. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your call, Steve. We have one more caller, Joe from Santa Fe. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the forum.
Good morning.
I'm in my early 40s, and one thing that I see going on in the movement right now is a little bit of, not a little, and this goes to what Sophia was saying earlier about the inclusion, which I do kind of get, but it's the butting of heads over the Latinx moniker. A lot of the older heads kind of really don't like it, and I can hear their argument. It says, you know, it kind of takes away, we only have so much energy, so it takes away some energy from the bigger fight. And then I get the argument of the younger kids, activists like my daughters, who are very active around two, almost several groups, you know, and they've gotten me to understand a little bit better why that is inclusive and important. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering what some of the older leaders, you know, thought about this, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or just a fad. I don't know.
Are you asking about what they think about working with the younger generation?
No, more basically about the Latinx title.
Okay.
Going from Chicano, Chicana to Latino. Some listeners might not even know what it is. Latino, Latina to just Latinx. It's genderless and...
Okay. Richard, do you have a comment on how that works? And then I'll go to Sophia.
Yeah, I wanted to just thank the two brothers that called in from Santa Fe. I just want to say that earlier comment that I made, it was made very clear to us as younger people in the 60s and the 70s. One, life didn't begin when we got involved. That's extremely important. And two, that we need to New Mexicoize any issues, projects, or programs that are instituted by the Black Bray organization. So I'm agreeing with the comment that have been made, but I think additionally the women have played a crucial role in the Chicano movement and the Chicano movement for many, many years, even as far back as the founding, Enriqueta Vasquez. I mean, we could go on with a long list of New Mexico women that have been leaders of organizations and that many, many of us were mentored by those women and by those men. So that's very, very crucial. I just wanted to add that to it. Lastly, just quickly, the interaction in the 60s and the 70s between the Young Lords, between the Black Panthers, between the Brown Berets, between the Black Berets, and the American Indian Movement were very, 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 very crucial. And still, as we go through this historical moment, I think our people need to dig deep into the history of New Mexico. And so that's very, very crucial to me. There's incredible activity that's taken place here for hundreds upon hundreds of years, the Pueblo Revolt and other issues. So I'll leave it there, Jasmine, and pass it on.
Mm. And Sophia, very quickly, we have about a minute. Do you want to comment on the term Latinx and how it works with the Chicano-Chicana movement?
And I just want to comment on Steve. Thanks for bringing up, because again, what Richard says, we have to have a contrary to a historical memory, and I wish Tobias Duran and those people were writing more. But in terms of, I think, going back to deconstructing and decolonizing, we also have to deconstruct is it about equity, LGBTQ, or is it really about class? And we need to think about all these things just as we need to. There's a lot of language that's being thrown out by intellectuals and the media, intersectionality. Well, we've always been intersectional, whether we use the word or not, right? And I think with the Latinx, the issue is not that the movement is homophobic, right? Because it's always good to judge other stuff, right? It's not necessarily that. I think it's just, again, that oppression Olympics of setting us aside as people of color. Who's more oppressed? Who's, you know, gender-wise, sexual orientation-wise? And I think that we need to deconstruct that a little bit. When has $30,000 been put into the Cesar Chavez or the MLK in a very symbolic thing like a crosswalk, right? The rainbow crosswalk across Central. Mm. So I'll stop there. And all I say is, like, let's deconstruct and decolonize, really, not just talk about it.
Thank you. We do have to jump out to a quick break again. If you want to join the conversation about Chicano and Chicana history and activism in New Mexico, give us a call, 277-5866. You can also tweet to us with the hashtag Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
It's a big week for Native artists, musicians, designers, and filmmakers gathered in Santa Fe, New Mexico for a number of events celebrating Native arts and culture. It's a cautious start after so many events were canceled in the past year. We'll hear from artists and organizers about what's coming up and their hopes for the future on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA, inside the writer's room with the creators of the TV shows Pose and Gentified. We're going to dissect what Latino representation looks like on the screen, scene by scene.
We historically haven't been able to tell our own narrative. It's always been through the white lens, and so the story's been told incorrectly.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Yasmin Khan. We've heard this hour from some of the history and current activism of New Mexico's Chicano and Chicana movement. Are you a Chicano activist in the community? What is going well and what needs to change? Give us a call, 277-5866. We're talking with Richard Moore and Sofia Martinez, and I'd like to introduce Jerome Chavez to the show. Jerome is a master's student in the Chicano and Chicana Studies Department at the University of New Mexico. In his work, he focuses on the history and social movements of the Chicano people that are often overlooked. Jerome, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Jerome, as a member of the newer generation of activists, why do you think remembering historical events such as the 1971 uprising is important?
Mainly because they happened, and we should know about them in general, because for a lot of our history, not many people know about it at all. And to know that the work that we do today does have a precedent, and just to know our history.
And how aware of this history is the newer generation of activists?
I helped do a teach-in on the 1971 rebellion. Richard and Joaquin spoke on it, and I found that a lot of people didn't even know about that event. And I think one good thing that came out of it is that more people know about that history. For Albuquerque and New Mexico itself, there's not much that has been talked about it or written about, and I think that just needs to change.
Mm. And very briefly, what are one or two of the other overlooked events that are important to New Mexico's Chicano and Chicana history that you've researched?
I'm currently doing research on. On the Chicano movement in New Mexico itself, mainly around the Black Berets organization, and there's a lot of connections. What most people know about the Chicano movement is with Reyes Lopez Tijerina and La Alianza, but they know about the courthouse raid in Tierra Amarilla in 1967. But there was a lot of activism around the land grants that was before and after that. Mm-hmm. And also the Tijerina did the laudable organizing in Albuquerque itself. And because a lot of the land grant people, were displaced from the land, and they lived in the cities. And there was... And a lot of organizations like the Brown Berets and the Black Berets, formed after that. And there is several other organizations like Los Comancheros, in northern New Mexico. It was a youth organization, La Gente. It was in Santa Fe. And I think overall that, we here in New Mexico, and especially in Albuquerque, have a really important part of the Chicano movement, and also the broader struggle for civil rights that was happening then.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We have Jessica from Albuquerque on the line. Jessica, thanks for calling in.
Hi there. Hi. Thank you so much for this conversation. I just wanted to say I'm from here many generations. My last name's Amigo. From the time I was young, I was told I was a Chicana, but it took me seeking out at UNM my roots to find out what that means exactly. But I very much identify with it, and I just appreciate the conversation because I get made fun of from my friends who are from Mexico or from my native friends who have, you know, a tribe they can identify with or a language or a culture. They used to always say, you know, "Ella no habla español," or, you know, she's, I had a boss one time from Seattle tell me that Chicano was a racist term. So anyway, I feel like I do a lot of educating on how I identify as a Chicana. I think it's a term, hopefully, that doesn't go away. But I just really appreciate the conversation and just wanted to say thank you. And hopefully there's a website, because I'm in my 40s too, a website where I can go and help continue the education. But anyway, that's all I wanted to say it's very underrated. And I can definitely identify with all the comments that have been made.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. And that does bring me to a question I want to ask of Sophia. So Los Jardines Institute has a library of Chicano and Chicana literature, including books that have been banned that talk about the history, banned books. And how has muting the literature on the Chicano experience impacted the movement? Like Jessica was saying, there's a lot of misconceptions about the roots of Chicano and Chicano history, and banning these books has probably made an impact. Can you comment on that?
Yes. Well, actually, the Libro Traficantes Underground Library were started by a group out of Texas that do have a radio, a Chicano radio, Chicano Chicana X radio program, you know, that features literature. But when Tucson basically attacked ethnic studies, closing out a high school program that was using 88 titles of basically internationally known literature, such as Pedagogy of the Oppressed, et cetera, right? And they closed down the project. Basically, the school board made the students and teachers box the books, 88 titles, and take them out of the district, right? And the battle for ethnic studies began in Arizona, which I think ultimately has been lost. I don't think they can teach ethnic centers in the high schools, right? But here in New Mexico, we have a long history, as people have said, of resistance, not riot, but of resistance. You know what I'm saying? And we'll take it to the street if need be, because we are here to protect our homeland. We're not rushing away from our homeland. We are like indigenous people. We are an indigenous society. We do not want to say that our struggle equals what our native brothers and sisters have gone to, our black brothers and sisters. But there, as people, historical people, Chicanos, we too are an oppressed people and continue to this day. So, so I think again, got off track there, but I think again that history is very important. And you know, today people don't even know about Chicanos. What do we see when people talk nationally about Hispanic? They look at Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and those people that came here based on the dictatorship that this country has supported in other Latin American countries, and they are the offspring of dictators that come to Miami, right? And so that is the political voice that is heard. So it benefits this system to keep Chicano voices, because we're historical voices that can point out the law and or the history. And even here in New Mexico, that's why really for a long time we've never had a president of the University of New Mexico that is Chicano, a president of APS that's Chicano, a director of the public education department that's Chicana or Chicano, right? Or whatever our particular orientations are. So we need to really get beyond our identity and think political movement and begin to strategize across our different issues.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. And I'd also like to welcome Tatiana Trujillo to the show. Tatiana is a master's student in the Chicano and Chicana Studies program at UNM, and her research is focused on food justice and migrant workers. Welcome to the show, Tatiana.
Good morning. Thank you.
Tatiana, as a member of the newer generation of Chicana activists, can you tell us how you see social justice intersecting with environmental justice in the movement?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it definitely goes back to, like, the 1971 uprise. I mean, there's not a lot of differences that are happening from then to now, you know, with people being environmentally hazard. You know, we are fighting for access to clean water. We are fighting for affordable housing. We are fighting for food justice. I mean, if you look at New Mexico as a whole, especially in the city, the South Valley, which has a lot of people of color, and especially a lot of Chicana and Chicanos, it's a food desert, you know? We have people who are living down near the Mountain View, in the Mountain View community, whose water is being polluted, and they have access to no clean water. And so these are a lot of the issues that a lot of those people in 1971 were fighting for and are still fighting for today. And mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of hope for the newer generation coming forward, such as being in the institution and getting a master's degree in the Chicana Studies program. I think there's a lot of privilege with that, but we can't forget that the institution has also really caused a lot of hazard to our communities and to people of color as well. And for it to take so long, I'm as well as Jerome, is I'm a part of the second cohort at UNM through this program. And so it took up until now for us to be even in the institution. So what does that say for other things as environmental justice issues? We're going to still continue to fight. And I think as a young Chicana woman, I think it's really important for myself to realize what it means to be a Chicana right now, mm-hmm. because a Chicana back then is not the Chicana now. And so we're having to rewrite that history, and we're having to also write the history for those women who are underrepresented as well. And so taking that and carrying it with me is really important. And I think being in partnership with individuals like Richard and Sophia, who have long lived these experiences and are continuing to teach these younger individuals, I think is really highly important to have this cross intersection between the older and the newer generation, because the fight is still the same. You know, we are still continuing to do this stuff. So thank you for having this conversation.
Thank you, Tatiana. And we do have Glenaba Martinez from Albuquerque on the line. Glenaba, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Richard. Good morning, Sophia. It's good to hear your voices. I hope you can hear me okay. I'm at work really quick. So first of all, I just wanted to really drive the point that it is important to have a strong critical historical consciousness about activist movements, not only nationally and globally in the 1960s and earlier, as the first, I think it was Juan who talked about the 1920s and reference to the Zoot Suit Riots and so on. But I think it's also important for us to understand how power operates and how power has infiltrated the ways that we now try to exercise agency. And I was talking to the KUNM person before, and I was saying, you know, when I was in college at UNM, I started in 1977. I'm from Taos Pueblo. And I recall the great relationship we had with Chicano studies, with African American studies, and in Native American studies. And Nejoni Days, which was put on by Native American Studies and the Kiva Club, was highly supported by Chicano Studies and Black Studies, the union. And then when Chicano Studies, when Bazan Romero and that whole group of students, when they put on the fiestas, they rearticulated the notion of the fiestas, and they made it political. And we were part of that. We also supported them. Mm-hmm. So that type of support, I'd like to see that happening in terms of social activism. And I'm really glad that Dr. Vasquez has the master's program. And I just want to thank Richard and Sophia for your lifelong work. That's all I want to say.
Thank you. And I'd like to go back to building on that, to what Tatiana said about generational influences. So Tatiana, how has the elder generation impacted your research and your work?
Well, I mean, it's just their true lived experiences, you know, and just sitting down and listening to what they have to say and actually getting the truth, like going back into our first conversations where our institution has definitely corrupted the system in a lot of ways and has manipulated it and dictated it into what they see it as, you know, and it to what it really truly isn't, the representation of Chicanas and Chicanos. And so getting this mentorship and getting this this truth is really vital to the existence and also keeping the stories alive. And so I definitely make that my priority within my own, not necessarily research, but just life as a whole, and keeping my truth as well as their truth alive. Because we have, as Chicanas and Chicanos, we have been written into this context of what America wants us to be and wants to see us as, and that's not the true existence. And I was raised in a household that definitely put the perspective of, you are a Chicana and you're going to represent that because that is our truth and that's who we are. We're not Hispanic. We're not Mexican. We're not Mexican American. We're Chicanos. And so holding that as my identity is important, and I see that within a lot of the elders that I reach out to, and the way that they conduct their work and the way that they are going through this movement. And mm-hmm. So it's my responsibility to keep that alive as well.
And Jerome, I'd like to ask you, for your work as a historian, how has working with the elder generation impacted your trajectory?
Well, I think I'm honored to know a lot of the people who participated in the struggles before, and that the work that they done that is still relevant today. And also, I feel a responsibility to try to record that history to pass on to other generations, and also just to know that, you know, in the movement, a lot of people gave their lives for it. Here in Albuquerque, there was two Black Berets, Rito Canales and Antonio Cordova. They were killed by the police in an ambush. They were allegedly trying to steal dynamite, but they were basically set up by the police and murdered. And I think decades later, one of the persons who led them there was mm-hmm. later revealed himself to be an informant, a police informant. And there's several other martyrs, nationally in the movement. Mm-hmm. And I think we just need to know who they were and to realize, the cost they gave for us today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I finally wanted to get very quickly from Richard, how can listeners participate in this movement? We're going to put links to Los Jardines and to other organizations online, but what do you say very quickly is the best way to participate?
Well, one of the things that I would very clearly say is our elders reminded us, and we will consistently remind others, one, never forget where we came from. Two, always remember whose shoulders we're standing on. And three, always give back to others what's been given to us. And so that's crucial. I think it's for the audience, to those listeners. We need to never forget that New Mexico is a neo-colony of the United States.
Excellent.
And so those historical pieces are very, very crucial.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. That's all the time we have for today. It goes so fast. Thanks to our guest, Robert Moore. Richard Moore, Sofia Martinez, Jerome Chavez, and Tatiana Trujillo. And thank you to everyone who called or sent comments. If you missed part of today's show or want to share it with friends, find the show page on KUNM.org or subscribe to our podcast. Just search Let's Talk New Mexico on your podcast app. Thank you, as always, to our engineer, Marino Spencer. Megan Kamrick screened your calls. Robert Maldonado live tweeted, and Ty Bannerman is our executive producer. I'm Yasmin Khan. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.